This is The Takeaway for Wednesday, September 20th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It was a scene of horror in Mexico after a 7.1 magnitude earthquake struck yesterday, killing at least 200 people. That's a number officials expect will rise. Dozens of buildings collapsed in Mexico City, and residents scrambled to dig through the rubble afterward. The quake came less than 2 weeks after an 8.1 magnitude quake killed at least 100 people in another part of the country. It was also the anniversary of the devastating earthquake that hit Mexico in 1985. Dudley Althaus is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal's Mexico Bureau, and he's on the ground in Mexico City.
There's about four dozen buildings that have collapsed in Mexico City. Many of them are like multi-story apartment buildings, and many of those kind of pancaked down. They just collapsed upon themselves, floor upon floor. We don't know how many people are still trapped in those buildings, but we assume a number of them.
Mexico City is a city with lots of experience with earthquakes. Were they up to code? Is every building up to code?
Well, you know, that's the thing. We've been saying for years, since the 1985 earthquakes, those of us have been here, we've had a number of earthquakes since, of course, and we haven't had that much damage. This is the most devastating earthquake we've had in 32 years. People used to say and kind of like comfort ourselves saying that anything that was going to fall down fell down in 1985. Tuesday proved that wrong. We don't know whether they were up to code. We assume not. And many of the buildings seem to be older buildings, say from the 60s or even the 50s, in neighborhoods that were developed in those days. It was very capricious. I mean, one building would fall and the buildings next on either side of it were okay. So you would assume that is probably a code problem. Having said that, a prestigious university in the southern part of the city had major damage to it and had four dead at that university. You would assume that building codes were up to par.
So as the sun came up on the second day after the earthquake and recovery efforts were going on all over the city, what did that look like?
The amazing thing is that a lot of people in Mexico City, neighbors, volunteers from everywhere just poured out and been working all night, helping soldiers and security forces to clear the rubble and look for the dead or the living.
Many of the neighborhoods, Dudley Althaus, that were devastated this time around had rebuilt after the earthquake 32 years ago, and the residents there seem to be experiencing some of this horror all over again.
That's correct. One building collapsed a few blocks from a large major hospital that was totally destroyed in 1985, right behind there. That neighborhood, it's a working class neighborhood in south central Mexico City, got hit hard again. We're going back out there today. The neighborhoods that got really hard hit, called Condesa and Roma, very close to Chapultepec Park in the heart of the city, had become in recent years, in the past 20 years, had really become a very gentrified and millennial or yuppie-ish sort of neighborhood. Very trendy bars, restaurants, the place to go out to eat, you know, the best new restaurants in Mexico City, you know, and that they got hit very hard. And we're just now still assessing the damage in those neighborhoods.
And there was another huge earthquake southeast of Mexico City in Oaxaca and Chiapas. Are these twin disasters straining the ability of Mexico to respond, or is emergency response and sort of the more chronic response that's required afterward doing okay there?
Well, that quake was 2 weeks ago, September 7th, off the coast of Chiapas, down towards the Guatemala border. And yeah, it killed at least 100 people and caused widespread damage in the states of Chiapas and Oaxaca, among Mexico's poorest states, heavily indigenous states. And the relief effort for that earthquake had really been ongoing. And, you know, there's all sorts of like collection points for people to donate food and clothing and everything else for the southern Mexico, all over Mexico City. Those efforts are now going to be turned towards Mexico City. Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto, in fact, was on his way flying to Chiapas, I think, yesterday. When the earthquake struck, he was just about to land in southern Mexico to supervise the recovery efforts from that earthquake. when they turned the plane around and came right back to Mexico City. The president said last night that he assured the people in southern Mexico that they're not being forgotten, but that the attention is going to turn to Mexico City for right now. Whether it's going to strain the capabilities of the Mexican government to respond to this, we'll have to see. I think that Mexico, since the 1985 earthquake, has gotten a lot better at civil protection, about responding to natural disasters, and about realizing what it's going to take.
Dudley Aldhouse, you were in Mexico City when the shaking happened. What was your experience? What did it feel like?
Well, we were in the office. We had just come, you know, this earthquake on Tuesday happened exactly 2 hours and 15 minutes after we had a earthquake drill, which they do every year to commemorate the 1985 earthquake. So that drills happened at 11 a.m. local time, and at 1:14 p.m. is when this earthquake hit. So at 11 a.m., most of Mexico City, everybody in Mexico City for the drill left their homes, left their offices, went into the street, preparing, practicing what you do in an earthquake. 2 hours later, the alarms went off again, and we don't know how many people just considered that a second drill and might have blown it off or did it again, but it was uncanny. We're all kind of freaked out that this happened. This earthquake hit about 32 years and 6 hours after the 1985 earthquake. The 1985 earthquake was a watershed moment in Mexico's psychology, political psychology and social psychology. It really galvanized civil society because the government response was so poor. People dug out the rubble themselves and just really kind of banded together. You saw the same thing happening yesterday and overnight last night.
Well, Dudley Aldhouse, you've lived in Mexico City, as I mentioned, for 30 years. How is this event affecting your sense of the city and your place in it?
Well, I mean, this is a very resilient city, and as bad as the earthquake looks and as bad as it was, this is a huge city. You have 44, maybe 45 buildings that collapsed in a city of tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of buildings. It's bad. It could have been much, much worse. The 1985 earthquake killed, you know, official figures say 6,000. Other figures go up to 10, 15 higher of thousands of people that died in that earthquake. This is bad. It's tragic, but this is a very recoverable moment. I think that this is going to galvanize people a little bit. I think that the fact you see these thousands and thousands of volunteers that worked all night clearing rubble, I think that has an impact on civil society here.
Dudley Aldhouse with the Wall Street Journal in Mexico City. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Todd.
We want to get some more perspective now on this disaster, on Mexico's preparedness, and on the road ahead for that country. We turned out to Jorge Guajardo. He was Mexican ambassador to China from 2007 until 2013, and consul general to Mexico in Austin, Texas from 2005 until 2007. Ambassador, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Todd.
Well, no country is ever fully prepared for the dual earthquakes that Mexico has experienced over the last week. What has preparedness looked like in your country, and how are people coping?
Todd, I'd venture to say that few countries are as prepared as Mexico for earthquakes. It's unfortunate that we had a massive earthquake in 1985, same date, an earthquake that shook the country then, literally and emotionally. Ever since, Mexico has been preparing for earthquakes. We have massive drills every year. People in Mexico City know what to do when this happens. Everybody knows how to act, where to go, how to volunteer, and that thought is very important. Everybody in Mexico City is volunteering in droves. And it's not as intuitive to volunteer in times of earthquakes. You gotta know where to go, what to do, what role to assume, what to bring. And in Mexico City, everybody seems to be knowing, so that is helping, and that is bringing the country together in such a terrible moment.
So what you're suggesting, Ambassador, is that people across the country, certainly around the huge metropolis of Mexico City, are prepared not just for the moment of the shaking and what to do, but also how to react in the hours and days afterward.
That is true, and that is very important. See, there are many things that you may not know, but for them, is absolutely intuitive. You don't smoke because there are fears of gas leaks. You bring water to wherever people are rescuing because people dehydrate very quickly as they're trying to pull out the rubble. You bring folding tables that serve as stretchers for pulling people out. One of the things that happens in these cases most often is you lose light, electricity in Mexico City, so there are no street lights working. So people start directing traffic. Volunteers start directing traffic. They know to leave the roads open for emergency vehicles. People in Mexico City know what to do, know how to react, know how to volunteer, know how to chip in. And that has been the one positive sign in all of this.
We also saw images on social media, Ambassador, right after the quake, of hundreds of people running to sites of buildings that had collapsed or partially collapsed, removing rubble with their bare hands.
See, that's the one thing. See, for instance, people know to bring buckets to these places because they use the buckets to collect the rubble, and then they form human chains to start removing the rubble. So that's right. People run to the rescue, and I was just, I mean, I'm in Washington, D.C. right now, but I'm talking, I've been all day on the phone talking to people in Mexico, how up to the quake struck at around 2:15 p.m., everybody started volunteering. By around 7 p.m., the army was deployed. The army has an emergency plan precisely in case of earthquakes. They were deployed, and still the people wouldn't go away because they knew the army would tire as well just because they're humans and it's such a massive task. So people hang around and they start refreshing, and those who can bring food or prepare food for the rescuers. So everybody knows there's a role for them to play. Everybody's playing it.
So that's largely people in the street, Ambassador, and people who know how to react. What about the professionals and emergency response? Often in huge cities like Mexico City, emergency response might be quite good, lots of drills, very prepared, and lots of resources. The quake last week, part of it was centered in Chiapas, the poorest state in Mexico. What has disaster response looked like there?
So unfortunately, you're right. The earthquake last week did hit some of Mexico's most impoverished regions. I do believe there was a good response, but probably just because it's not the capital, or probably there aren't as many news outlets covering the event as there are in Mexico City, just because it's the capital of the city, it doesn't get as much attention and people quickly forget it or put it behind of their minds. I would say the Mexican government has been very proactive in reaching out to these communities and trying to help. Unfortunately, they are not as present just because they tend to be more marginalized. They're not in the capital city that has all the media coverage that comes with being a capital.
Ambassador Jorge Guajardo, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Todd.
Ambassador Jorge Guajardo was the ambassador from Mexico to China from 2007 until 2013.
The Takeaway is supported by Roadside Attractions, presenting Stronger, starring Jake Gyllenhaal as Jeff Bowman, whose strength became a symbol of hope after a national tragedy, in theaters September 22nd. By Indeed.com, where business owners and HR professionals can post job openings, review candidates, take notes, and schedule interviews from an online dashboard. Learn more at Indeed.com. And Fracture, creating modern photo decor by printing their customers' photo directly on glass. A Fracture is image, frame, and mount all in one, available in a selection of square and rectangle sizes. Learn more at Fracture.me.
I'm Todd Zwillick. Welcome back to The Takeaway, and we turn now to the Caribbean, where yet another powerful hurricane is tearing its way across the sea. After hitting the island of Dominica, Hurricane Maria made landfall in Puerto Rico early this morning. Here's how Puerto Rican Governor Ricardo Rosello characterized the storm earlier today.
This is a clearly going to be the most devastating storm in the history of our island.
Well, while Puerto Rico contends with what could be the most devastating storm in its history, the destruction left by Irma just last week brought leaders from Europe all the way to the Caribbean, pledging to rebuild their territories and former territories there. Here's French President Emmanuel Macron when he showed up on the French side of Saint Martin.
Saint-Martin will be reborn, and I will be back in a few months to be here by your side.
Meanwhile, over on the Dutch side of the island, they spell St. Martin a little differently, and Dutch King Willem-Alexander was there.
As a Kingdom of the Netherlands, we'll stand together and make sure that St. Martin comes back on his feet.
Well, every time a European or American official appears on a Caribbean island, it's a reminder of a colonial past, and also that each of these places has a different relationship and different histories when it comes to more powerful nations. And all of that can make a big difference when a disaster like a hurricane strikes. Joshua Jelly Shapiro is with me here in the studio. He's author of Island People, the Caribbean and the World. Joshua, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Hurricane Maria has hit Dominica. It's also hit places like Guadeloupe, Antigua, Barbuda, the U.S. Virgin Islands, just to name a few. Does readiness and preparedness depend on whether you're an independent nation or have remained a territory of some country in Europe or the United States?
Yes. You know, in certain ways, I think it absolutely has. The Caribbean, it's sometimes said, is a kind of big social science experiment. What's meant by that is that these islands, of course, share a great deal in terms of their history. They were basically populated by African slaves brought to the region to cut sugarcane. But now they all speak different languages, have different relationships with those old colonial powers. And I think that on many of the islands, whether they're independent or whether they remain a part of France, in the case, for example, of Martinique and Guadeloupe, matter a great deal in terms of their infrastructure, in terms of their readiness, in terms of how they handle disasters like this.
So give us some examples. What have you noticed in the preparedness for these storms that we've seen lately, or in the reaction and the recovery that goes to these islands' relationships with a parent country?
Well, in a place like Dominica, which, you know, was hit horrifically hard by Maria yesterday and the night before, Dominica is an independent country. It was a British colony for a very long time. Before that, went back and forth between France and England. But in many ways, it's a place that remains quite undeveloped. It doesn't have a big airport. It doesn't have a formal relationship with its ex-mother country. And in many ways, its infrastructure is really quite unprepared for a big storm like this. And we saw that in terms of the devastation wrought there, something like 90% of buildings damaged. And that's in contrast, right, to its neighbors, Martinique and Guadeloupe, which in the 1950s, when many of the islands were becoming independent, elected to remain a part of France, and in many ways still have infrastructure that you'd identify with a place like France, you know, good roads and housing and all the rest. And Maria didn't hit them as hard, but as you saw, the damage was much less. And part of that was about the ways in which they have a superior infrastructure to a place like Dominica.
What about a place like Anguilla, which is a protectorate of the United Kingdom?
Yes, absolutely. And those British islands, right, these overseas territories, which are, you know, essentially colonies in all but name, they decided to remain a part of the empire, but they're overseas territories. So they're not actually, right, a part of the country like Martinique and Guadeloupe are. And so I think what you saw in a place like Anguilla and in the British Virgin Islands, right, was that they were not necessarily so prepared because, right, they don't have the access to resources or that their personnel and British army and all the rest who are there and ready to go, right? It took some time to get help there. And that's because they have this kind of marginal relationship to Mother England, as they're called. But it's also the case that in Anguilla, you saw quotes in recent days saying they are looking to, quote, Mother England for help. You know, this is where they look to. Those old colonial relationships absolutely matter in these places.
And what about Mother England, as it's called, or Mother France, or even Mother Netherlands in this case, or Mother United States? Each of these countries must differ in the amount of attention, the amount of money that they would devote not only to preparedness, but to a disaster response.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are sort of great distinctions across these different countries in the way that they deal with their territories in the Caribbean. And of course, it's important to recall here that the U.S. has its own territories in the region, the U.S. Virgin Islands, but also Puerto Rico, right? And people in those places pay U.S. taxes. And as we saw, right, the president did declare a federal disaster in those places, making federal funds available to them. But I think it's going to be a very interesting story in the next couple of days as this storm hits Puerto Rico. It seems full force, and there may be, you know, really significant damage there. And Puerto Rico, of course, is in the midst of its own travails. It recently became the biggest public default, right, in U.S. history. The government is essentially bankrupt. And I think we're going to be in a position where there's going to be the need for serious aid sent to Puerto Rico. And I think that will be quite an interesting debate, perhaps, in Washington. It may be trickier politically than sending a lot of money to Texas, for example.
Well, Joshua Jelly Shapiro, these storms that we're seeing are likely to become more frequent and more powerful and more destructive. Are more powerful countries the ones we're talking about planning and budgeting for that? Is there a chance they'll eventually de-emphasize preparedness and recovery when it gets more expensive and more frequent, and that islands could find themselves more out on their own?
You know, that's a really interesting question, and that was actually a question that was debated just this week at the UN. There's quite an interesting development where representatives of Caribbean countries, the Dominican Republic and a few others, began to make the case that climate change, you know, this is a problem that all of us are contending with, but is one that the richer countries are in large measure responsible for in terms of carbon emissions and so on, and being in a position to mitigate climate change's effect. And so these islands have asked the rich countries to say, you know, you need to take a sort of sustained and permanent approach to this and think about it not in terms of just reacting to disasters, but helping us contend with this climate change that we've all caused. But as many people on these islands know, and going way back to colonial times, you know, Native Americans, the Taino and other peoples in the islands, knew that you shouldn't live right by the shore, you know, that storms are dangerous. And I think that over recent decades with tourism and as we've seen in Florida, this trend to build right up to the edge is something that we as a species seem to do these days, but it is looking like an increasingly unwise way to live.
Joshua Jelly Shapiro is author of Island People, the Caribbean and the World. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. And if you watched late night TV last night, you might have seen Jimmy Kimmel take another swing at Louisiana Republican Senator Bill Cassidy in their ongoing fight over repealing the Affordable Care Act. Now, the Senate appears to be heading toward a vote on Cassidy's try at repealing the ACA. That vote could come next week. Support for the legislation has grown among Republicans over the last week. A group of Republican governors has come out for the bill. Meanwhile, people who oppose it are speaking out as well. The Secretary of Health from Senator Cassidy's home state of Louisiana publicly criticized his bill this week, saying it would cut off Medicaid benefits for hundreds of thousands of poor people in the state. So we wanted to ask someone in Louisiana to give their view on how this latest version of ACA repeal could affect their state. Susan Todd is the executive director at 504 HealthNet. That's a nonprofit that provides support to healthcare providers in the greater New Orleans area.
I do really worry about the fact that right now we have 435,000 people covered through Medicaid expansion. And if this current law goes into effect, or this current proposal, I should say, goes into effect, then we would see that coverage erased. We would really see the progress that we've made go backwards. And it's not something that we want to do.
Give a sense of what that would mean to the health for those 430,000 people.
It would really mean a difficulty in getting needed medications and getting needed access to services. Right now, we've really seen a difference for people who are getting coverage through Medicaid expansion. We've seen 14,000 adults receive colon cancer screenings. And of those, you know, we're looking at a little over 4,000 who have had cancer averted. So they've had polyps removed. And we're seeing a difference in terms of our health and our health outcomes now, because people can get screenings, medications, the care that they truly need that I think everyone should have access to.
What about on the private market, another part of how the Affordable Care Act functions? What do the exchanges look like in Louisiana, and have they been functioning well?
So we have about 200,000 people statewide enrolled in the exchanges or the marketplace. And, you know, I think initially they were functioning a little bit healthier, a little bit better. Lately, we've seen insurance companies drop out. And so in Orleans Parish, you're really looking at only one carrier. So you're looking at Blue Cross Blue Shield, who are off our plans through the marketplace. And so I think we have seen premiums increase through the marketplace, just like everywhere else. And so it has become, you know, more unaffordable for families where this is really their only option to purchase insurance, because they make too much to qualify for Medicaid, but they're employer doesn't offer them insurance. And so we do definitely need some federal action and support to stabilize the marketplace and to make sure that those premiums come down so that insurance is more affordable.
Could you talk a little bit about the special case of Louisiana? It's not alone, but it does have a particular challenge. Big urban centers, New Orleans and to a lesser extent Baton Rouge, and then the rest of Louisiana is just really, really rural. What does that mean to people's healthcare?
I think what that means is that when you're in a rural setting, then it is harder to go see a primary care doctor because there just aren't any. You know, also thinking about the fact that rural hospitals need to be supported, because it is important to have that hospital in a rural setting so that if someone is in an accident, they don't have to travel hours, you know, to get the care that they need, or something like managing chronic conditions. Again, you want that access to care so people maintain their health and that on the front end, they're a lot less expensive and, you know, talk about a sort of emotional and mental impact as well, but to make sure that people are healthier on the front end than later on the back end. And so wanting to make sure that we're supporting our rural health centers, that we're supporting our rural hospitals is incredibly important because we want people, again, to have access to care no matter where they choose to live in this country.
One view on the Affordable Care Act and healthcare reform from Louisiana, the state represented by Bill Cassidy, a senator at the center of this debate, Susan Todd, executive director at 504 HealthNet in New Orleans. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
There's just 1 week to go until voters in Alabama head to the polls in that state's Republican Senate primary. This is the race to replace Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who left the Senate when he took that job. Now, Alabama is safe territory for Republicans, but this Senate primary has turned into a kind of GOP war. President Trump is headed to Alabama on Friday. Now, he's given his support to the appointed current Senator Luther Strange. Luther Strange also has the backing of Senate Republican leaders and donors, but it's Strange's opponent who appears to be leading in the polls now. Former Judge Roy Moore has a history of incendiary statements, confrontational politics, and he has the support of recently departed White House strategist Steve Bannon, and the chance to greatly disappoint Republicans like Mitch McConnell, who very much want Luther Strange to stay in the Senate. Pat Duggins is here. He's news director for Alabama Public Radio with the latest. Hi, Pat.
Hi there, Todd. Don't you hate these boring Senate races?
Well, you know, Republican primaries like this one don't usually turn out to be this exciting and this instructive about what's going on in the Republican Party. So President Trump is headed your way. What does that mean?
Oh, well, not just Mr. Trump, but also tomorrow we have Sarah Palin and Sebastian Gorka. They're coming in tomorrow to stump for Roy Moore. And then you have the presidential roadshow coming in on Friday. So a lot of focus on this, what, as you say, would probably just a run-of-the-mill Senate race, but everybody's interested in it.
And so why these different factions in the world of Republicans here facing some pretty powerful forces off against each other?
Well, Roy Moore, in a strange sense, Roy Moore is more of a Donald Trump kind of a cut of cloth Republican. He doesn't believe in the Republican establishment. As you notice, there's a lot of support for Mr. Strange coming, for example, from Mitch McConnell. And then along comes Donald Trump, who's now supporting Luther Strange. So it is a bit of a jumble there. But with Roy Moore, again, if you want to compare him to Mr. Trump, look to his base, and his base are more likely to show up in December for the general election. So everything seems to be in play.
It appears to some analysts that President Trump may have sort of misfired here in his support, maybe not realizing what the politics were like on the ground in Alabama. But Mitch McConnell, meanwhile, Pat Duggins, has been spending a lot of money, or at least super PACs associated with Mitch McConnell, I should say, have been spending heavily in the state against Roy Moore. What is McConnell so afraid of here? Why doesn't he want Roy Moore in the Senate?
Well, probably because Strange is more of a get-along kind of Republican as opposed to Roy Moore, which, again, since that seems to be where Mr. Trump is leaning, it would seem that he would like Roy Moore better, but he doesn't. He seems to like Strange more. So, again, it's sort of all over the map.
Now, Roy Moore is famous, might be known to people across the country for refusing to remove a monument to the Ten Commandments when he was a judge. He's run up against authorities in that way.
Yes, he did. And then he was booted out for that. And then fast forward to the Supreme Court's decision on same-sex marriage. Roy Moore allegedly told all of the probate judges who basically run things in Alabama's counties that they didn't necessarily have to follow what the Supreme Court said. And that got him suspended for the rest of his term as Chief Justice of Alabama. So, again, you know, both men have political baggage. I mean, Roy Moore has his and Luther Strange has his.
And let me play you a piece of tape from just this week. This is Roy Moore making a statement on Sunday that turned out to be pretty controversial, at least outside of Alabama.
Now we got blacks and whites fighting, reds and yellows fighting, Democrats and Republicans fighting, men and women fighting. What's going to unite us? What's going to bring us back together? A president? A Congress? No. It's going to be God.
You heard Roy Moore there saying blacks and whites are fighting, reds and yellows are fighting. We got to let you go, Pat Duggins, but it might be easier to see why Mitch McConnell would rather not have this kind of rhetoric in the Senate.
And look to Roy Moore's base. They're going to support him no matter what, and that could make things interesting.
1 week to go until this Republican Senate primary in Alabama. The general election is in December, but Republicans are probably in a safe position to keep this seat. But the fight is on for who wins this Republican primary in Alabama. Pat Duggins with Alabama Public Radio. Pat, great to talk to you.
Thank you so much, Todd.
Support for America's new credentials on The Takeaway is funded in part by the Joyce Foundation.
We've talked a lot on this show about alternative paths to the middle class as America's economy changes. For a lot of people, that means bypassing a traditional four-year college degree. And as technology plays a bigger and bigger role in the economy, some people are enrolling in coding boot camps. For-profit boot camps have sprung up all across the country. They're trying to capitalize on the demand for skilled programmers, but some students see them as a chance to train up for a stable career without that four-year college degree.
I was kind of in a phase of my life where I didn't know what I wanted to do for a career, and it's a weird thing to find out when you're 28 that, like, hey, I don't know what I want to do for a career because you're kind of already set in your ways, but I knew that there was lots of opportunity working with code.
That's Brett Caudill. He took a three-month intensive course at a coding boot camp called Dev Mountain in Utah, and now he's working there as an instructor. Brett told me how that happened.
I came to Dev Mountain as a student. I wanted to learn to be a software engineer. And when I graduated, I was invited to come on as a TA. We call them mentors. I did that for 3 months, and while I was a TA, I taught a couple of workshops. The other instructor at Dev Mountain said I had a knack for teaching. He sat me down one day and basically said, I think that you could be an instructor here. I sort of thought about it for a bit and said, yeah, absolutely, I'd love to do that.
Did you have any real computer experience or coding experience before you decided to go to school for it?
No, I had no experience coding, no experience working in software. I worked with computers. I had an affinity for computers, but no experience.
So was this just the kind of thing where you had friends who said, hey, coding, there's jobs in it, there's money in it, try it out?
I think that I was led to it because I wanted a career where I could work really hard, where I could solve problems, where I could create software that other people could use. And I had no idea if I would like it or not. I just had the inclination, something in me said, maybe I'll enjoy this and I should try it out. And I wound up loving it. It was kind of serendipitous that I just fell into it. But I knew that there's great career options in it. I knew that there was lots of opportunity. And I knew that the companies tend to have really great work culture.
Well, it seems like you took a bit of a risk here, though, because you paid $10,000 for an intensive three-month boot camp program. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I actually quit my job, too. So I lived in San Diego at the time. I made the decision to come out to Utah to pay $10,000 to go to a boot camp that was only going to be 13 weeks. So
right.
There was a lot of risk involved.
And look, I mean, you went to a for-profit school, and we've all seen late-night advertisements for maybe, you know, people like you who are mid-20s or 30s, don't know what they want to do, looking for a new career, kind of bored with what you're doing. Sometimes we hear reports that those schools are, some of that training is like a dead end. Were you afraid that that might happen to you?
Yeah. My first initial thought when I saw an advertisement for a coding boot camp was, this has got to be some kind of scam. I didn't believe it. I remember sitting down with friends of mine, and we're both looking at, like, this doesn't seem right. We did the due diligence. We did the research. So I felt when I decided to take that risk that it was a calculated risk. I didn't feel like I was wading into unknown territory. The other really big thing for me was that I talked to somebody who actually attended Dev Mountain, a friend of a friend. So I made that connection on my own. They said that they enjoyed the experience, that they were working in software, and they were a waitress beforehand and had no coding experience. Very similar story to myself.
Did you see yourself before this as the type of guy who would have gone to college, regular four-year college, short of traditional college, instead of something like this?
I actually never graduated high school. I wound up getting my GED, so I was a high school dropout. And up until probably the moment I dropped out of high school, I always thought that I would be the kind of the guy who would get a college degree. And when I revisited this later on in my life, the first thing I looked at was getting a college degree. I looked at options and I wanted to know what kind of schools there were, what kind of programs there were, and what kind of outcomes they had. And it was daunting because it was a significant investment of time and money. And when you're 28 and you think about, I'll be 32 when I graduate, that's a little daunting. And so before I decided to jump into that, I said, I want to look around and see if there are other options available.
Well, it's great because in a way, this is just like high-tech modern trade school. I mean, in another era, as a young guy, you might have joined a union and been a steam fitter. You know, we don't have tons of steam fitters anymore, although we do still have and need that trade. But this doesn't seem so very different from that.
I agree. I sometimes have kind of thought of it like as like a becoming sort of like a blacksmith or something like that. You just have this skill, this ability. You learn this ability. And once you have this ability, companies will hire you. They want people who are pleasant to work with and who can write software. And if you can do that, there's a place for you in this world. It's a meritocracy.
You mentioned your friend who went through the boot camp who was a waitress. Are there a lot of women who were in your class?
No, not in my class. And we have not seen a lot of women at our school. In a cohort of 20 students, there might be two or three women. And that kind of mirrors or reflects what we see in the software industry as a whole.
Do people talk about that in your culture and at your school that they would like to see more?
Yeah, we do talk about it. It's definitely something that you notice when you're at our school. You kind of look around and you go, wow, there's overwhelmingly men here. And we talk about it as a staff too. There's really no reason why there shouldn't be a lot more women in this industry. I know that Dev Mountain has done some things to try to reach out to women who might be interested in coding. There's a school in San Francisco called HackBright. It's a coding boot camp that is actually an all-women school, but that's pretty rare. I mean, you don't see a lot of female programmers.
Anyway, once the word gets out a little bit better, Brett, you might get more because apparently there's money in it and there's jobs, and that's good for everyone. Brett Caudill used to be a student at the boot camp at Dev Mountain learning to code. Now he's one of the teachers. Brett Caudill, thanks.
My pleasure.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick. And, you know, if you had hung out with teenaged me, it would have sounded something like this.
I got a letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it and said they were suckers.
Yeah, I listen to a lot of punk and a lot of hip-hop, of course, tons of David Bowie. And at times, I'll admit it, I rocked a pretty awful mullet haircut. I worked at Friendly's Restaurant on Chocolate Avenue in Hershey, Pennsylvania, waiting tables there. And I got to that job in a very sleek 1986 Honda Civic hatchback in beautiful primer gray. So I worked during the summers in high school. I drank a bit. I never smoked. And I definitely would have dated if I could have. But the portrait of today's teens looks a lot different than that. There's less smoking, less drinking, less dating, less sex, less driving, and less working than there used to be. That's all according to a study out this week in the journal Child Development that examined the behaviors of teenagers and how those behaviors have changed over the last 40 years. Dr. Jean Twenge is author of that study. She's a psychology professor at San Diego State University. She's also author of iGen, Why Today's Super Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood. And she joins me now. Jean Twenge, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, this is a huge study. 8.4 million young people followed and surveyed over 40 years, 1976 to 2016. What did you find?
Well, we found that today's teens, I call them iGen, like iPhones, that iGen teens are much less likely than teens in previous decades to have a driver's license, work during the school year, go out without their parents, date, have sex, and drink alcohol.
So all of these things are down. Working is down. Dating is down. Drinking is way down. Lots of other sort of traditional teenage behaviors as well. What's behind it?
Well, that's always the big question. So we drew from evolutionary psychology, which has this theory about a slow life strategy. And that means the whole path of development is slowed down, because that's really what's happening here. It's not necessarily that teens are more virtuous or responsible or mature or immature. It's just that they're taking longer to engage in both the pleasures and the responsibilities of adulthood. And that slow life strategy tends to appear in environments where it's going to take longer to raise that child to full adulthood, and it's going to take more careful nurturing. So it tends to happen when people have fewer kids and when the environment is safe and there's a fair number of resources around.
Well, what about the less drinking and the less sex? Does that mean that young people are less rebellious than their parents?
Well, you know, the less rebellious part has to do with this, that iGen teens actually fight with their parents less than teens in previous decades. So that suggests that they're more or less willing participants in this ride of growing up slowly.
It's difficult to take 8.4 million teens over 40 years. Of course, part of the point of this research is to find out the reasons behind this and make some statements, but there have to be intervening factors. Race, geography, certainly income, I imagine, plays into this pretty heavily.
Yeah, so that's what's great about these big surveys that we drew from, is they are nationally representative, so teens of every background are included. So we were able to do that to look at whether the trends were the same across all of these demographic groups. So we were able to look at socioeconomic status, social class, race and ethnicity, region of the country, whether kids were growing up in a rural, urban, or suburban environment. And we found across the board that these trends were really, really consistent across demographic groups, because that'd be an easy guess to make of maybe this isn't showing up among more disadvantaged populations, but it is. And the amount of decline in adult activities is extremely similar across all of those groups.
So, Dr. Jean Twenge, you know, it's easy to imagine for 8.4 million teens, millions and millions of parents over the years and across the nation having this, you know, when I was your age conversation, the one that none of us ever wants to hear. But this is all about the kids. What about their parents? What about their parents' attitude toward these changes and that things are different?
Yeah, so, you know, this really is a larger cultural change. It's one of those situations where it's not just parents, it's not just kids. It's that overall in the culture, there's a lot of support for the idea that teens should take longer to grow up. There's just not as much tolerance for, say, young teens in particular, going out and, you know, drinking and having sex. It used to be that was much more of the standard. So parents want to protect their kids more. They place more of an importance on that. And teens are going along with that.
Well, we're talking so much about the things that teens are doing less of, you know, than their predecessors. All of this kind of asks the question, what are they doing? I mean, are they doing something more than a teenager in, you know, 1990 would have?
Yeah, they're on their phones.
Yeah.
So they're on social media and texting and communicating with their friends electronically. So depends on the survey, but the average teen these days spends 6 to 8 hours a day of their leisure time on some form of a new media screen. So given that, that may also be one of the reasons why there was an acceleration in this decline in adult activities, particularly in the last 5 to 7 years, because kind of coincidentally, most of those adult activities involve getting out of the house and doing something in person with your friends. So whether that's going out or dating or driving, teens feel less need to do that because the party is on Snapchat.
And right before we let you go, Jean Twenge, I'm going to ask you for your prediction. You knew this was coming. You just studied the last 40 years. So knowing what you know, quick snapshot, the next 40?
Well, that's always a little hard to say. But I suspect that the iGen you know, who are now kids who are going to be the teenagers in the next 5 to 10 years. I expect these trends to continue, especially for the youngest teens, that we're going to keep going with growing up slowly.
Dr. Gene Twenge is author of iGen, Why Today's Super Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood. Dr. Gene Twenge, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Now, we put the call out here, and you answered telling us about your teenage years.
This is Lucas from Stillwater, Oklahoma.
Julie from Duluth.
Jane in San Francisco.
Jesse from Morristown, New Jersey.
When I was a kid, I dated quite a lot, drank more than I have ever since I turned 21, and partied so much I ended up in another state.
I teach high school now, and the worst of them are no worse than the worst of the kids in my graduating class.
I drank and partied and dated as much as I could in my teen years. As a girl with very low self-esteem, I was in constant search for approval and got it from behaving in dangerous ways. Probably not much has changed.
I did plenty of dating, drinking, and partying as a teenager. And my teenager today does a lot of the same, but I think social media brings the current activities to more dire circumstances. It's scarier now.
It is a teenage battle, as always. You can give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can send your tweets at The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway. Out here in the fields, I fight for my meals. I get my back into my living. They're all wasted.
The Takeaway is supported by Roadside Attractions, presenting Stronger, starring Jake Gyllenhaal as Jeff Bowman, whose strength became a symbol of hope after a national tragedy. In theaters September 22nd.
PRI, Public Radio International.